I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday at the White House, President Obama said it was time for Congress to decide on health insurance reform by voting up or down on health care legislation that was passed by both houses. Speaking to the Republicans who have complained that the only acceptable course of action was starting over, Obama said this.
I don't see how another year of negotiations would help. Moreover, the insurance companies aren't starting over. They're continuing to raise premiums and deny coverage as we speak. For us to start over now could simply lead to delay that could last for another decade or even more. The American people and the U.S. economy just can't wait that long.
Mr. Obama did offer some sweeteners to the Republicans, asking Democrats to incorporate some GOP ideas in their bills. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell said no dice and that the Democrats are shoving this bill down the throats of the American people. President Obama will be in Philadelphia on Monday to lobby for a health care bill. So today on Radio Times, after a year of wrangling over health care, is Congress, is the country ready for change? And we begin our conversation with Howard Fineman. He's a columnist for Newsweek magazine, and his book, The 13 American Arguments, is out in paperback. And Howard Fineman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be with you.
I feel like we've had this conversation before.
I'm sure we have. This is an ongoing conversation in American society for years, and especially in the Obama administration, which is where we're going to try to cover everybody and somehow rationalize the system at the same time. That's the question. How much communal effort is there? What's the role between the private market and the government? These are arguments we've been having forever. In fact, that's sort of what my book is about. And Obama's trying to bring them to fruition here with this vote.
Well, let me ask you some political questions here. But do you think then bipartisanship, as small as it was, is officially dead when it comes to health care legislation?
Oh yeah, I think it's dead. I think the fact that the president wants to brag about incorporating some Republican ideas, and they aren't just Republican ideas. Things concerning malpractice and rooting out fraud in Medicaid and so forth. I mean, those are not really partisan ideas. But he wants to say that not because he's expecting to get any Republican votes, because he's not, but because he wants to try to woo or keep moderate and conservative blue dog Democrats who are critical in the math of this.
And do you think this will work?
It can't hurt. you know, it's a close vote. The way that's going to go down is eventually, and I don't know exactly when, the House leaders are saying in this month, but you never know, it's Congress. There will be a vote in the House on the Senate bill. And they are short of the 216 votes they need. That is, Pelosi and the president are short of the 216 they need. They're not wildly short, but they're short. They need to convert some blue dog Democrats to vote yes. They need to prevent a revolt by the tough pro-life wing of the Democratic Party, which doesn't want to vote for it. They need a vote on that, and they're going to twin that up with some kind of bill, a reconciliation bill, that will try to sweeten the deal for House members. In other words, first they'd have to vote for the Senate bill, but on the promise that this other bill would expand coverage further, have more regulation, things that House liberals want. How you do that while at the same time getting the Senate to pass that second bill is the trick. And then even if you can do that, you've got to deal with the abortion, the pro-life dozen, if you will. It's like a Rubik's Cube. It's difficult, but that's the ballgame.
And what role do you think the president will play? He is coming to Philadelphia Monday. He's going to another city. And he has been criticized for not being more proactive on the need for reform in this country.
Well, the problem he had, first of all, on Pennsylvania, I mean, there's some members in Pennsylvania, Jason Altmaier, Congresswoman Dahl Kemper from up in Erie, who voted no last time, and these are two Western Pennsylvania Democrats who voted no, who they need to vote yes. So that's why he's going to a place like Pennsylvania. That's why he's going to Missouri, because Ike Skelton, a very key Democratic committee chairman there, voted no last time. So the president is first, he's going to make his presence felt in their states. He's going to beg and plead with them. He's going to schmooze them up. He's going to threaten them, probably, not these particular ones, but he'll He'll try to twist arms, and then he'll try to buy them off. I mean, we're down to the buy-off stage. Everybody objected to the to the Nebraska gift to Ben Nelson and the Florida gift to Bill Nelson, et cetera, et cetera. Believe me, there are going to be a lot more of those things if Obama hopes to get this passed.
And isn't that how we do whether we like it or not, whether it's in back rooms or not? Isn't that how legislation?
At the end, after all the philosophy is over with, okay, and everybody has had their arguments, when it comes down to a few votes like this, it's everything on the table, everything up for grabs, things totally unrelated to this, I'm sure will be discussed. By the president, by Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, that's the way it's going to go. If it's going to pass, that's what's going to have to happen.
And what is the pressure on the Democrats, either in Congress or the White House, to pass some legislation? Since we've been debating this for, I think it's starting a year tomorrow.
Well, Marty, you can look at this two ways: either is a heroic slog by the president, who, after all, is of partly Kenyan descent, and, the Kenyans are long-distance runners. You can look at it that way. Or you could look at it as a fool's errand, that because the polls, this legislation in some respects is neither here nor there. It's neither the sweeping single-payer government-run program that they have in other countries that some people think makes sense, and that to some extent Medicare, is, and Social Security is. Nor is it a thoroughgoing sort of market-based thing where everybody gets a voucher and, it's not a radical libertarian idea either. It's your typical, all-too-typical American sort of marble cake of mixed ideas. It's confusing. It's complicated. The president keeps saying 30 million more people will be covered, but other people who already have insurance, perhaps selfishly but legitimately, want to know, hey, wait a minute, how much is that going to cost? I think there's been a lack of simplicity and clarity in explaining exactly what the proposal is. Merely to say the word reform, to sprinkle the word reform over everything as though it were some form of holy water, doesn't work. And the American people, who were so skeptical of government to begin with, are skeptical of this. That's why the polls are where they are.
Do you think the Republicans then have done a better job criticizing this bill?
I think they've done a better job criticizing it than the Democrats have, especially the White House has, explaining it. And that's partly because the president decided to let Congress take the lead on this thing and design it themselves. And, the old phrase about, a camel is an animal designed by a committee.
Exactly.
Well, this is a camel piece of legislation that's kind of weird to look at and, to some extent, hard to understand.
Well, and it's even hard to understand some of these rules in the Senate, and we probably don't have time to get deep into it. Nonetheless, the president has called for this up-and-down vote,
yeah,
which translated means reconciliation, a simple majority. But looking at the Senate, is anything simple in this institution?
No, it's not simple. And the fact is that nobody has the moral high ground in using reconciliation for purposes other than that for which it was designed. And, George Bush did it for tax cuts. You could argue that reconciliation is only about budgets and spending, so tax cuts came within it. But he was also threatening to use it, to jam judges through back during his time. It's been used for other things. So nobody has the high ground. The key thing is going to be whether that first vote, whether they can get the 216 in the House. If they can't get that, all the rest of it doesn't matter. If they do get that, then I think the thing will pass.
And what happens is, in the end, do you think if something like this does pass, it'll be closer to what the Senate came up with than what the House came up with?
Well, yes, but because the other bill they're designing, the bill that will be subject to vote under reconciliation, is going to try to meet Nancy Pelosi's so-called 3 A's, which are more access, more accountability, and I forget what the third A is, but the basic idea is more people covered, more subsidies for people covered, more accountability for the, I think that's the third one, for the insurance companies. In other words, make the bill sort of more liberal, to use a shorthand. That's the idea of the reconciliation bill. Trick will then be to get the Senate to accept that. Meanwhile, the Senate is not going to budge on its abortion language. They're not going to make it more draconian, more forcefully pro-life. And that's going to make it difficult for that reconciliation bill then to pass in the House, if you follow what I'm saying. It's probably going to come down to, I think, in the end, whether Bart Stupak of Michigan and the other pro-life Democrats are willing to sort of swallow hard and accept the language that's currently in the bill, which they don't like.
You wrote recently in Newsweek about an experience you had at a hospital. You got, sounds like, pretty ill while visiting your daughter in Argentina. I think you got something, what, you got food poisoning?
Well, I got food poisoning, and I ended up getting dehydrated, and so I ended up in a small private hospital in a resort town called Bariloche. And what I wrote in the piece was I got excellent care. It was a sort of pedestrian thing. I mean, I was sick, but it was not a serious illness. They treated it perfectly. I was in there for 2 days, had top doctors, top medicine, good equipment, all that other stuff. It wasn't fancy, you know, it wasn't fancy, but it cost $1,500 for, now, even correcting for currency and cost of living and so on, that's a third of what I would have paid in the United States. And it caused me to ask rhetorically in the piece I wrote on Newsweek.com, where does all the rest of the money go in the United States? I think everybody knows we have, in some respects, not only a wonderful and heroic, but overbuilt system that gold plates a lot of things, that does unnecessary procedures, that gives everybody a private room when they don't necessarily need one, or the government shouldn't necessarily have to pay for one. The system is out of whack. There's no question that our system is out of whack. This year, I think we're going to spend 17%, 16 to 17% of our entire gross domestic product on health care. No other country spends anywhere near that much. And that's unsustainable. Everybody knows it's unsustainable. This is an agonizing situation we're in, where we know exactly what the problem is, but nobody can agree on how to solve it.
And a minute before we have to say goodbye here, but looking at what Congress is grappling with, is Congress ready to deal with the high cost of our health care system
in a serious way?
That's
the question, Marty. I mean, the Congressional Budget Office says that the Obama bill over 10 years will save $100 billion. It will actually help cut the deficit. I believe that their calculations are correct. If you believe Congress is going to follow through with the guts to actually make the cuts that they say they're going to make. And if they impose the taxes that they claim they're going to impose, even though they've already pushed them back to 2018, you know, to 2018. So it's a continuing effort at will that the American people have to express, and people have to be honest with, we all have to be honest with each other, and I don't find that necessarily happening anywhere in this debate right now.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Howard Fineman, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Sure, Marty, anytime.
And he's a columnist for Newsweek magazine, and his book, The 13 American Arguments, is now out in paperback. And we will continue our conversation with Princeton University's Uwe Reinhardt, talking more about healthcare, the cost of healthcare, our cultural views about healthcare, the politics of healthcare. And we'll take your calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Germantown Friends School Juried Craft Show supports WHYY. The GFS Craft Show celebrates crafts by showcasing 74 craft artists from around the nation. The 26th GFS Craft Show takes place this weekend from Friday evening through Sunday at Germantown Friends School. Café des Artistes opens Saturday and Sunday. For details, 215-301-4711 or online at germantownfriends.org/craftshow.
It's 10:20. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. Coming up at 11, we'll talk about this Sunday's...
The Philadelphia Museum of Art supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday night. This Friday, Chibo Motto co-founder and Beastie Boys collaborator Miho Hattori performs songs from her solo project. Miho's eclectic taste in music fuses with her Japanese heritage, producing a genre-defying sound, blending bossa nova, hip-hop, funk, and rock. Details at philamuseum.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Getting a reality check on what Americans really want and need when it comes to health care. We just said goodbye to Newsweek's Howard Fineman. And now we welcome Uwe Reinhardt. He's a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. And Professor Reinhardt, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Do we have our guest? We need to get our guest up, and we are again, Uwe Reinhardt, do we have you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, very good, and thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. I know you were listening in with Howard Fineman, and we ended by him saying that we all know what the problem is in this country when it comes to health care, which is that we're on an unsustainable path in terms of costs, but we don't seem to have the guts to fix it. Do you agree with his assessment there?
Yeah, as far as costs are concerned, he's right. We all do agree that there is a problem with cost and that it is unsustainable. As far as the uninsured are concerned, I don't think we all agree. There are quite a few people who really don't think it's that big a deal. And other things, it's a huge deal. So there's division of views. But on cost, I do think we all agree. The problem with it is, I always quote facetiously Alfred E. Newman's
cost my favorite
equation,
yes,
which is that every dollar health spending is someone's healthcare income, including fraud, waste, and abuse. And the fact that it is income to people means that you can expect any cost containment effort, whether from the private insurance industry or the government, to be fought fiercely by the people who book health spending as income. That is one of the in our democracy, that means it's an uphill battle. I always say it's an insurgency that'll take at least 10 years to put down. But I think we have to do it because it is unsustainable. And who was it? Herb Stein's law that said if a trend cannot possibly continue, it probably won't.
But that's a very gloomy prediction, and I appreciate you saying it, but what you're saying is that so many of the players in the system are wedded to the expense of the system, and as we know, it is wasteful in many ways. There are a lot of redundancies. We pay a lot of money at the end of health, at the end of somebody's life, but that the system is really designed to keep the status quo.
It is. And part of it isn't just venality. Part of it is really sincere. Mm. Take pharmaceutical companies and device manufacturers. They will argue if you reduce health spending, that is our revenues, we cannot deliver to you these wonderful products that we have been delivering, and you have to admit they have. Then the hospitals say, you look at us, we have a 1% profit margin. Many hospitals are closing. Often hospitals are the major source of employment in the community, so they will have a very sincere belief that it's tragic to close them, so they make that case. The physicians say, I have to close practice, I retire early, because with all the hassle and the little reimbursement I get and the high malpractice premiums. So everyone actually puts forth a very credible case, and that's what makes it so difficult. And then you have people who say, even raising the question whether some heroic procedure is worth its cost, conjures up pictures of Adolf Hitler, as we saw when the Washington Times had a headline, an editorial saying, efficiency can be deadly, and they put next to it a picture of Adolf Hitler. Mm-hmm. So you have all of that banging into this debate. It's gone totally off the rocker.
Well, it has, and I'm thinking also of when there was talk about some of those end-of-life conversations that they got translated into things called death panels.
Death panels, yeah.
But so, as you said, it requires an insurgency. Does it also require a president with a bully pulpit to try to address some of these systemic problems within our system?
Well, as I have put it, it requires a General Petraeus who understands insurgents to deal with it. You know, the rule among military people is an insurgency takes 10 to 12 years to put down. But this is a sort of democratic insurgency. These people don't carry self-propelled rockets. They have little bags with campaign contributions. Mm. And here's a little secret the American people may not know. It costs always more than twice to elect a president than the most recent president. That is, every 4 years, the cost of electing a president, and I bet you it's true of members of Congress too, doubles. And these poor politicians have to raise those monies. Therefore, they cannot afford to offend the source of this money, which is these powerful interest groups who book health spending as health care income. It's really a vicious circle. The fault is the way we finance campaigns. But the Supreme Court just came out and said, throw in more money by saying corporations can exercise free speech by making campaign contributions. Can you imagine how hard it will be to have cost containment when the people who are the politician's source of campaign financing, are the people whose income you want to cut?
Well, let me be naive here. there are calls in the bills and from the president for making sure that people are not hurt by pre-existing conditions, a call to cover more people who are uninsured today. In spite of the system that we have, if the country is able to, and I guess this would be Congress, is able to incorporate some of that and pass some of that, would that improve our system?
Well, it would improve the plight of lower-income families who are now often face the choice, do I go to the doctor when I'm worried, or do I just tough it out, or if they go, end up under fiscal stress, even bankruptcy. That would be actually fairly easy to do. And I do believe that if Democrats sat together with Republicans to figure out, let's at least deal with the worst of it, you could get that done. I know a lot of Republican policy analysts and politicians who would go along with this. If you look at Senator Coburn's bill, for example, you will find in it at least a long way resolution of that particular issue. Now, that costs $1 trillion over a decade. That's the Democratic price tag. The Republican probably would be lower. But nevertheless, even $1 trillion over a decade is only 3% of the $34 trillion we are now projected to spend on health care in the next 10 years. So that $1 trillion that everyone calls this huge price tag actually isn't a huge price tag. It's only 3% of total health spending. This habit of expressing everything in 10 years has completely confused the American people, because they relate that $1 trillion to our $14 trillion GDP today and think it's a big amount of money. It would be, of course. But you got to relate that $1 trillion for subsidies for the poor to the $155 trillion GDP we'll produce in the next 10 years.
So we can afford it from your perspective?
Oh, yes, we can certainly afford this. The issue is, how do you then finance it? Well, it would mean some people, myself included, would have to pay more taxes, mm-hmm. and it might mean that we have to really hunt for wasteful spending and not spend on waste anymore and use those monies to fund the subsidies. And again, I believe in cooler moments, Republicans and Democrats could really get together on that.
But we don't live in a cool moment time.
Not at the moment. It's, I think, now almost impossible to do, certainly bipartisan health legislation. That's dead. But even to getting a partisan bill through, as Howard Feynman said, is dicey enough.
You have said that we really don't have a system of insurance in this country, health care insurance. We have a system of uninsurance. The idea being that if you lose your job, and sadly millions of people have, you're also going to lose your insurance, assuming that you get it from your employer.
That's correct. The employment-based system is much loved by the American people, and it has served the American people fairly well. But the problem is, it is ephemeral. when you lose your job, you lose that coverage. You can buy it with your own money for another 18 months or now with federal support. Nevertheless, even after 18 months, it runs out. So this is really not a solution. What you really want is portable insurance that sticks with you no matter where you work, which means eventually Americans should decouple insurance from the job and have individually purchased portable insurance. Now, that actually happens to be a Republican idea, which I have always endorsed, because I don't like the employment-based system for that reason. Democrats always want to shore up the employment-based system, and I always scratch my head and ask why.
But do you think, I mean, with a system where everyone, I guess, makes a decision for themselves about the kind of health insurance that they want, do people have, and this is not to underestimate to the public, but do people have the kind of knowledge that they need to make that kind of smart health insurance decision?
Well, I personally believe that the kind of people who walked into this subprime mortgage crisis as they did, mortgages are a lot simpler than health insurance, probably not capable of organizing health insurance in a market that isn't substantially regulated through exchanges. But you find the idea of exchanges even in Republican Senator Coburn's bill. He openly talks about exchanges and even referenced the Dutch and the Swiss system who have exchanges as models for that. So you could structure, if you had standard policies that are good and that people could trust and understand, like homeowners policies are regulated that way, where you don't have to read 20 pages of fine print. If you had those policies at least available on an exchange, I think individuals could handle this market. But you have to structure that market for people.
And an exchange where plans would compete with each other?
Yeah. When you look at General Electric, for example, they have an in-house exchange. It's called the Personnel Department, and in it, the Employee Benefit Department. And the Employee Benefit Manager, a good friend of all of us, he manages this exchange for all GE employees, and it works exceedingly well. All we're talking about, for people who are not working for large companies like GE, the states should organize an exchange where they could have the same benefit that a GE worker has. That's all these exchanges really are.
And that's Professor Uwe Reinhardt, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University, and we invited him to join us today on Radio Times to talk, yes, once again, about our healthcare system and calls for changes to that system, both from the White House and in Congress. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. One of the issues that Republicans have called for, and the president says that the Democrats should at least take a look at, which is this issue of tort reform, looking at malpractice. From your perspective, is that a place where the U.S. can save money? Is that a fruitful part of our system to look at?
Yes, you can save money, but not a lot. The Congressional Budget Office looked at that issue, and they came up with an estimate of some $60 billion over 10 years, or half a percentage point of health spending. So it won't be the solution, but it couldn't hurt to look at it. But there is another reason why you might want to look at it. One is this issue of defensive medicine, meaning that doctors very often claim, at least, to do things not for clinical reasons, but for legal defense. Preemptive legal defense. So they'll do an extra test and they say, I don't actually need this test, but if I'm ever in court, they'll ask, did you do the test? And I did. And some physicians in a recent survey claimed that 26% of what they do is defensive. I find that high. Others have said it's 10%. Some of that might be saved, and this could be a larger saving than the CBO had estimated. But the third one is really the psychological cost imposed on physicians of constantly having this little devil on your shoulder. Every patient is a potential litigant That is not conducive to good medicine, I think, when a doctor sees every patient as a potential enemy. And I think it makes medical practice unpleasant. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, now, we should change it. Now, do we have to study it again? I think, frankly, the president is being disingenuous here. He should have taken this issue more seriously early on, because we have already studied this issue to death. There are great scholars, Mark Hall at Wake Forest, I believe, Randy Borberg at the Urban Institute, many others who are lawyers and health economists or physicians who have studied this and come up with alternative dispute resolutions. We wouldn't really have to study this a lot. We could actually move forward with remedial action now. Now, what the Republicans propose is to put a cap on non-economic damages for pain and suffering. I think that's a meat axe approach, because depending on the degree of suffering, injured patients should get more compensation for pain and suffering. That is what these alternative models that have been proposed, they actually would not have a one-size-fits-all solution, a cap. They would use alternative dispute resolution. But that has all basically been studied to death.
Well, and we've probably done some of those interviews on some of those studies, and one of the findings was, and this is obviously isn't for everybody, and there are cases where people are grievously harmed and sometimes even die as a result of medical care, but the fact that a doctor can admit a mistake apparently reduces the chance of some kind of malpractice suit.
Yes, this is what they have, of course, in the airlines. When pilots admit they made a mistake, there may be some remedial action, some more simulated training, etc., but it isn't held against them. But if they conceal a mistake, they get fired.
Hmm.
And the same is the case here. If physicians could admit a mistake, and things do happen, of course, without necessarily feeling the boom will be lowered on them, they would report them more easily and probably put systems in place that would avoid these mistakes. For example, giving patients the wrong doses of drugs. The proper remedy there is to have a computerized system where some handheld device checks whether that's the right dose. A lot of these are systemic problems, not even that a physician is negligent or malicious.
The idea of a checklist or washing your hands, some kind of basics of healthcare.
Yeah, Atul Gawande's checklist, for
exactly.
Example, which is when you go on an airplane, you see pilots go through that. And they do it sincerely, although they have done it for the thousandth time. The thousandth first time, they go sincerely through that list to avoid mishaps.
Let's take a very short break. We've got a full bank of calls here, not surprising, because we are talking about healthcare legislation, how to improve, make fixes to our system. And our guest is Professor Uwe Reinhardt. He's a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. He's been a guest on Radio Times several times talking about this issue. It's an important one, and it's still a live issue down in Washington, D.C. And we've got calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, low energy, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
It's 10:40. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. Coming up at 11, an exploration of the sounds of silence with Emmy-winning acoustic ecologist Gordon Hempton. Hempton has traveled all over the world recording ambient sounds. He's searched for the rare spaces untainted by the noise of human machinery. That's at 11 on Radio Times. And today's WHYY forecast, cloudy and windy with scattered light rain, highs around 40 degrees. Tonight will remain cloudy with lows around 30.
The Patriots Theater at the Trenton War Memorial supports WHYY, presenting Jesus Christ Superstar, with lyrics by Tim Rice and music by Andrew Lloyd Webber. Set in two acts, Jesus Christ Superstar tells the story of the final 7 days in the life of Jesus of Nazareth, featuring such notable songs as Superstar, Everything's All Right, and more. At the Patriots Theater at the War Memorial, Tuesday, March 9th at 7:30 p.m. 609-984-8400 or warmemorial.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Princeton University's Dr. Uwe Reinhardt. Let me get to Wendell from Kennett Square to join our conversation. And Wendell, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
All right, sure. I'm a big fan of Professor Reinhardt's writings, by the way.
Great.
They're very amusing and very enlightening. but
on a serious subject.
To everyone.
Indeed.
In any case, I was curious what it seems to me that a single-payer insurer scheme of financing of medical services makes a lot of sense for business as a whole. And I wonder if Professor Reinhardt thinks there's any chance that, let's say, a Republican, an enlightened Republican, maybe after the midterm elections, might try to enlist support from business for something like that.
For a single-payer system, Wendell?
Yes, from business, whose interest I think that scheme is in.
Well, that's an interesting question. And Professor Reinhardt, I'm also thinking of those car companies that are struggling in Detroit. And part of their struggle is the fact that they have to provide expensive health care and pension benefits to their employees.
I think the Republicans would reject that idea because they have an alternative idea, which is to say to organize exchanges and to let people buy individually purchase policies that are portable between jobs, which Republicans would tell you will achieve the same thing, which is getting business out of the need to have to finance health insurance. They would never go for a single-payer system simply because they do not trust government. So that idea will never, I can't even contemplate Republicans do it simply because they have already proposed an alternative to it.
Wendell, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me get Carl, also from Kennett Square, to join our conversation. And Carl, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Great program.
Thank you.
I actually work in the industry, but I'm not going to talk about that. My comment really has to do with an issue that your guest brought up, which I agree with 100%, and that is the fact that our hospitals and our healthcare system are operating at 1% to 2% profit margins. And that flies in the face of the fact that a lot of the vendors who provide products to our hospitals operate at 20 to 30% profit margins. You look at J&J, a darling of Wall Street, they tout the fact that they operate at a 27, 28% gross profit margin, and yet they're selling those goods to our hospitals who are losing money day in and day out.
Carl, that's a very interesting point. Let me get Professor Reinhardt to respond.
Well, if hospitals were paid DRG by, say, every patient, that is, they get a flat fee per case, and then would have to shop around for good prices from vendors, in some way this problem, in my view, should solve itself. Because, you know, a hospital purchaser or a hospital purchasing alliance, of which there are several, could shop around among different vendors of medical products or drugs and then get good prices. So you wouldn't really have to have government get in and regulate this. That sort of thing the market should be able to handle, because these are products, not services to people who have cancer. They're just products. They're commoditized, and you should be able to get the profit margin further down. Now, the producers of that technology will, of course, tell you if you do that, they won't have money for R&D, and you've heard those stories. But I believe this will come one way or the other, whether the producers like it or not. Once we move from fee-for-service to bundled payments and hospitals or groups of doctors get one payment for the whole treatment of a medical episode, they will shop around and bargain sharply for lower prices for these inputs. That's already coming. If you look at the Medicare drug price situation, there has been a wholesale shift to generics, which really has been a devil in the neck of the pharmaceutical industry. And so the market has actually handled this problem.
And are you predicting, are you saying, Professor Reinhardt, that we will move eventually or maybe piecemeal from a fee-for-service system to bundled payments?
I think, yes, this will take some time to do. I estimate 5, maybe 10 years, where we started, you know, case by case. First, you bundle the easy, like a normal delivery. You can have a bundled payment for mm-hmm. that. A coronary bypass is increasingly so standard, you could have a bundled payment for these cardiac cases. And we'll go sort of case by case and roll it up, but there is now research underway to do this by private insurers. The government is putting money down to research it. Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has done it. I think this will come. And then the traditionally fairly high margin in the device and pharmaceutical industry will come under pressure.
Let me get Wes from Princeton to join our conversation. Carl, thanks for the call. And Wes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I'm calling. So I appreciate the goal of the insurance exchanges, but one problem that I see is that health insurance is like you were saying, very complicated. And so it seems, so for example, if it's regulated that a certain kind of health insurance has to cover procedures that aren't experimental to some level or something like that, who's going to end up making the decision whether a procedure has to be covered, right? I mean, it seems like these are complex decisions. For two different insurance companies to really be on the same footing in that kind of exchange, there would have to be some sort of regulation about what their actual decisions were and what to cover. And it seems like that's actually the most complicated part of insurance. Mm-hmm. And if you remove that from the decision-making power of the insurance companies, then, I mean, it seems like you're taking out... I mean, it seems like the hardest part about having a single-payer system is actually making the decisions about what to cover. And it seems like you might end up having to do that anyways just within an exchange.
Wes, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Professor Reinhardt.
This is a very astute observation. This is, in fact, a worldwide problem. What do you cover and don't you? In some countries, say England, they have the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, where they actually estimate, well, how much does it cost per quality of life year saved with this procedure? And at a certain point, they say this isn't, quote, worth doing. We will not cover it. In the U.S., you cannot even raise this question, and you saw the hysterical reaction with death panels and so on. So we're not there yet. At some point, we will have to come to this decision. Private insurers in some way already quietly are making those decisions, but there you can say, look, if I'm the ABC insurance company and I decide not to cover it, if you don't like it, go to someone else who does cover it. So they are in some way off the hook. The problem Americans fear is that if the government does it and prescribes it, then it'll be dictated and there's no appeal. So that issue will take at least another half decade for us to discuss openly, hopefully without allusions to Adolf Hitler. Just as an ethical proposition, this is a hard one the caller raises here, but it has to at some point be made. For example, with these new specialty drugs, it will one day happen that in order to buy another year of life for a patient, it may cost $500,000. Mm. And the question then is, if that's taxpayers' money, do we want to buy life for unknown fellow Americans at $500,000 per life year? At some point, this problem will stare us in the face, whether we like it or not. We may decide, yes, we do. Or we might say, you know, maybe not. And then Medicaid and Medicare will not cover it.
And this gets us in, and this is something that you've written about, gets us into this question about the American culture, what we value, what we believe in. And we seem to be a country that values independence, people making decisions for themselves. But if we're talking about healthcare, the question is, are we all on our own to figure this out for ourselves? Or do we all share in a system where what happens to you affects me?
Well, Marty, that is the problem. There are two problems in connection with that. One, not everyone is actually able to think through some of these complicated issues. Again, we are people that had trouble with mortgages. These are complex issues that involve clinical decisions, biological, ethical decisions. So that's just one thing. Can every patient even digest the technical information? But then the other part of it is some people are rich and some are not. And if you're on your own financially, you may very well decide, gee, I'd really like to have this drug, but I can't afford it. And then the question comes back to the problem, should the government force your neighbor to buy that for you through taxes and government programs like Medicare or Medicaid or subsidies? And I think you just can't run away. I testified before Congress, and one congressman threw at my face that I had said, human life is in fact not priceless. The price of human life is not infinite. Otherwise, we would have, for example, equipped our troops better when we went into Iraq. And he was very, very upset about it and asked, how dare you tell me what my life is worth? And I said, I'm not telling you what your life is worth. I'm raising the question, to what extent do your neighbors have to chip in by force of government to buy you an extra life year? That is a legitimate question to debate. And somehow to call that fascism is wrong. Because after all, we do leave a lot of people uninsured in the country now.
Looking though, and I realize in Europe, each country has their own system, but have European countries resolved some of these ethical, philosophical issues that we still seem to be grappling with in this country?
Yes, they have. They make these coverage decisions, particularly England, in a very explicit way with NICE, that then recommends to the government whether or not to cover a procedure. And Germany had a similar institution, which is now with a new government under review. But nevertheless, they make those decisions as well. And Australia does it, and Canada does it. And of course, we look down on these countries because they make those decisions. But at some point, given the huge deficits we face, and given, don't ever forget, over half of all American health spending is already tax-financed. Now, over half. At some point, we do need to ask, is that actually the best way to spend money? If you want health, there's a lot of research that says education is far more important to determining the health status of population than health care. You might get more mileage in terms of better health by educating people better, particularly in how to manage their health, not to become obese, not to take cholesterol too lightly. That may yield you more good health than putting it into heroic medical care. We need to have, at some point, a rational, civilized discussion that doesn't descend into what we saw last year.
Let me get, Wes, thanks for the call. We've got Kira now from Atlanta joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Kira, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Several months ago, the American Cancer Institute, I believe, came out with a study that they had done that stated that it was actually against standard of care to be doing as many mammograms as we're doing, that they should be started later and not done as often. And I, from people I work with and so on, it had nothing to do with Obama. It had nothing to do with the health care debate. But there was all this hue and outcry about rationing. And I think this ties into what you were just saying. But I'm just wondering, politically, how do you get around this? And how do you get around the issue of if you start saying, well, we're not going to practice defensive medicine anymore, people saying, how do you establish the standard of care, I guess, is what we're saying. I'm saying that.
No, I hear you, Kira. And I mean, it's a big question. Let me give Professor Reinhardt a chance to respond.
Well, this particular study was done by an independent council of essentially clinicians, although apparently not oncologists, although they took studies from oncologists under advisement and came out with a report that said basically doing mammograms on women under 40 is not cost effective because you will detect very few cancers and the cost per screening. They didn't even use cost. They just said the psychological cost on a woman who has a false positive and then has a biopsy and so on. They just said within the clinical realm, it doesn't make sense. But they also said something very, very carefully. First of all, they didn't bring dollars in at all, number one. Number two, they did not say it shouldn't be done. They said a woman should discuss that with their doctor, whether or not the risks, the clinical risk of doing the test, particularly with a false positive, is worth the agony. And it was really a sort of heads up. It is perfectly legitimate for a clinician to discuss with the patient not to do that procedure. And the idea then would be, in case of a court case, you could say, look, this isn't standard medical practice. But there was nothing in that report, if you read it fairly, that said doctors shouldn't do it. They simply said this shouldn't be automatically be done. Well, over 50, it should be automatically done.
And Kira, thank you for calling into Radio Times. And Professor Reiner, we're almost out of time, but just keying off what she said. I mean, is it possible to have a rational conversation in this country about our healthcare system?
I really have despaired. I've been here for some time. I don't think it has ever been as bad as it was last year in particular. And the question now is, supposing government changed hands, and supposing the Republicans had the White House and the Congress, will then the Democrats do the same and extract vengeance and simply filibuster everything that comes down the pike so that we will descend into deep bitterness? So I think what it might take is to have a president like Eisenhower or, and in some way, Reagan, where you just wouldn't dare do it.
Well, you know, on that note, I want to thank you very much, as always, for joining us on Radio Times. Always a lot to think about and talk about. Thank you, Professor Reinhardt.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. He's a professor of economics, public affairs at Princeton University. Appreciate you joining us as well. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member-supported public media.